really talking about Dante's fame in light of the fact that it will enhance his own fame.
And notice, of course, what's implicated there is that what he's saying to Dante is, if you follow your constellation, you cannot fail to reach your port of glory. Well, that means, from Brunetto's point of view, that your name is going to be in lights. Dante's not taking this journey so that his name will be in lights, okay? He's taking this journey to get out of this moral swamp that he's in, and in the process, he's going to take this journey that's going to lead him to see God, to the vision of God face to face, but he's doing that so that he can actually go back and take that journey again when he dies. In other words, the answer to life is not fame down here on earth. That if you look for that at the exclusion of other more important things, what you're doing is, in a very real way, failing to be fruitful and multiply. What you're doing, in a very real way, is sort of cutting yourself off from the larger reality of fruitfulness that is the goal of all humans, but that, you know, Dante has to relearn himself. To put it another way, of course, if Dante were to follow Brunetto's advice, then it's highly likely that Dante would wind up here with Brunetto. It seems to me that this is the way in which Brunetto is a sort of revealing himself far greater than he realizes.
And Dante the Pilgrim, as we've seen him before, sort of falls into this trap. After all, this is a very attractive thing to hear from a senior to you, a mentor, a famous person. In fact, Dante says, gosh, Brunetto, I wish you weren't dead yet, because you were the one who was teaching me how to make myself eternal. You were my mentor, my guide on making myself eternal. Well, what a funny thing to say to a guy who's down here with fire dripping down on him for all of eternity. Dante doesn't quite get it. Now, again, on the surface, we might say, gee, making yourself eternal sounds like a pretty good thing to learn. But what does Brunetto teach him about how to make himself eternal? Brunetto himself gives us a clue, because at the end, when this conversation sort of terminates and sort of they wave goodbye to one another, Brunetto says, remember my tresor, a book he wrote, where I live on. Making yourself eternal is all about getting yourself famous. My eternal life comes from the fact I wrote this famous thing. And this is a great danger to a genius like Dante.
It's also interesting, you know, I suppose that a case could be made that maybe one of these days Brunetto Latini Studies is going to come back, and a lot of people are going to want to study his works for his own sake. But by and large, when people read works like Brunetto's Tresor nowadays, they read them so they can find out some more about Dante. And it's sort of interesting, if you think about it from that perspective, Dante is the one who gets the fame. But paradoxically, he gets it because he has to learn how to write for different reasons and different purposes. If you're looking for the fame, then you become a footnote to somebody else. It's also interesting, if you think about this, when you go back to Francesca, with Francesca, Dante had to learn that there were wrong ways to read per diletto. Now what he's learning is that there are wrong reasons for writing. And in a sense, in his embodiment of them, as somebody down there in hell, Brunetto presents a lesson in wrong reasons for writing.
Now what we're going to do is leave the circle of the violent and enter into the very deepest part of hell, the third major subdivision. Beginning the next lecture, we're going to take some looks at sinners who are guilty of category of sin we call fraud.
Lecture 9, The Sin of Simony.
You'll recall that the Inferno is divided into three major subdivisions, incontinence, violence, and fraud, and that we dealt with several examples of violence in previous lectures and said that they were all part of one circle, circle seven. Well, in the nine-circle structure of the Inferno, then, we have two more to go, and both of those are concerned with the third major category, the sins connected with fraud. Remember that these are sins connected with misguided intellect, that what Dante does here is deal with all of the ways in which our capacity for wisdom as human beings is perverted, turned upside down, ruined. And he's also particularly concerned with the large social implications of this kind of sin, the failure to achieve community, or the way these sins destroy community. His way of setting this up for the eighth circle is to have a series of concentric ditches called bolgia in Italian, and in each of these 10 ditches we have examples of the sin of fraud. Now, again, as was true with our discussion of incontinence and our discussion of violence, what we're going to do is look at representative examples and sort of suggest to you that what we say about them would be a really big help in reading the other bulges on your own. But we're going to start by talking about one of the most interesting and one of the most consequential of the sins of fraud, what was called in the Middle Ages the sin of simony.
It may not sound like the biggest deal today to us, but obviously it was such an important thing in Dante's day. In fact, by 1300, the church had been campaigning for 200 years against the practice of the buying and selling of church offices. But in fact, not only had it probably gotten worse, but it had, if you will, trickled up so that the popes themselves were involved. And in fact, we're going to be in the 19th canto, the third ditch of the eighth circle, where we have popes who are being punished for this sin. So it's a very serious sin in Dante's day. A second thing that makes this canto important for the dynamic of the Inferno is we're going really to see here the growth of Dante the Pilgrim. That is to say, obviously, if we take the whole 100 cantos, to use Ron's phrase from an earlier lecture, Dante starts out dumb and ends up smart. In some ways, the 19th canto is that movement in microcosm. And therefore, even in the course of 140 or so lines, the average length of a canto, we're going to see real change in the character of Dante the Pilgrim.
One other thing to say before we find our way into the text, we've been talking in various places about the kind of audacity of Dante to write a poem like this, a poem of this magnitude, a poem that takes on these subjects. But this is a sort of good place to see the audacity of his presuming to know what people's final resting place in the afterlife is going to be, because, of course, he doesn't hesitate to put into this particular canto, into this particular bolgia, popes, the spiritual leaders of Christendom in his time. And it seems to me that we have to kind of remind ourselves of just how radical such an assessment would have been, and just how sort of fraught with, you know, sort of danger almost Dante's decision to do that would be seen as. It's very interesting to think about this also as a kind of microcosm of Dante's audacity in writing the entire Commedia.
We begin with Dante the poet, the author of this poem, really strongly speaking us and sort of waving a flag in our faces and say, pay attention, folks, this is a big one. O Simon Magus, O scum that followed him, those things of God that rightly should be wed to holiness, you rapacious creatures, for the price of gold and silver, prostitute. Well, he begins with a particular name, Simon Magus, turns out to be a character, oddly enough, in the Bible. In particular, in the Acts of the Apostles, he makes a fairly brief appearance. Peter and John are laying on hands and conveying the Holy Spirit. And Simon comes along in chapter 8 of Acts and says, that's really cool. I would really like to do that. How much does it cost? And Peter has an interesting response. I paraphrase, but not very much. Go to hell, Simon. Go to perdition. The things you're talking about are things of the Spirit. And you can't use money to purchase things of the Spirit. You're really radically confused. And so this biblical character is invoked here at the very beginning.
And it turns out that this biblical character also has a kind of interesting post-biblical life. Not being satisfied with Peter's answer, he goes out and learns the arts of black magic and then comes back to kind of bug Peter. That's the technical word. What he actually does is spend a lot of time kind of opposing Peter, his magic versus Peter's preaching and healing. And it all comes to this great climax in this sort of Western shootout before the letter, when they get to Rome. And Simon goes up to the gates of Rome, jumps off and begins flying around and basically says, hey, everybody, look at me. Who do you want to follow? That guy down there or me? Peter prays and says, Lord, if this keeps going, an awful lot of people are going to go over to Simon. And at that point, he does this wonderful nosedive, hits the ground, and sort of goes into the ground so that his feet are kind of flapping in the breeze. And this image of the fall of Simon the magician, magus is simply the Latin word for magician, becomes a very popular image throughout the Middle Ages, and especially from the 12th century on, to depict kind of the consequences of the sin of simony. So followers of Simon are simonists. They buy and they sell church offices. That is to say, more generally, they kind of take the things of the Spirit and pervert them for their own material gain. So in this ringing invocation at the beginning, the poet is saying, hey, pay attention. This is a biggie, and I'm going to give you a real treat in terms of what I'm doing here.
And so after this invocation, Dante and Virgil begin to explore what's going on here. They sort of look around and see what they see. And what that is stone holes cut in the stone in the bottom of this ditch. And there are legs sticking out and flapping around and whatever. And in the description of that, as Dante so often does, he says, let me tell you what that sort of reminded me of. Let me give you an earthly analog. To me, the holes, seemed no wider and no deeper than those inside my lovely San Giovanni, in which the priest would stand or baptize from. And one of these, not many years ago, I smashed for someone who was drowning in it. Let this be mankind's picture of the truth. Well, let's start with just unpacking the image. There was a separate building for baptism because baptism was a communal event in Italy in the Middle Ages, and therefore the baptistry of Florence was, in a real sense, the center of town. And if you went inside in the Middle Ages, alas, not now, because the furnishings have changed, but there are furnishings like these that survive in other places such as Pisa, you would have found a baptismal font, sort of a hexagonal pond, and you would have had stone holes at each one of those corners big enough for somebody to stand in. And therefore, what you'd have is, on the day of the year when all the babies were baptized, who were born that previous year, the priest would stand in those holes, take the baby from somebody, turn around, baptize the baby in the water, and then turn around, hand the baby back. And he said, those stone holes down in hell reminded me of these. And by the way, he says, I took a sledgehammer one day and smashed that sucker in the baptistry of Florence, presumably because something like this had happened. When it wasn't in use, one of those holes had gotten some water in it, and a baby had gotten stuck in it and was in danger of drowning. So I smashed the baptismal font to save a baby from death. It seemed like an odd incident that Dante sort of justifying something he did back on earth, but also there's no historical record it ever happened. We don't know for sure. But at any rate, it just sort of adds to the fact that we have to ask, what's Dante doing here in this little apparent aside?
Well, one of the things that he seems to be doing is apologizing for something that, if misunderstood, if seen from the outside, would seem like an act of blasphemy. That is to say, here he is going around with a sledgehammer, destroying church property. And, you know, you can just see the tabloids, Dante, local poet, turns out to be church destroyer. And you have the little picture of Dante with his hammer. What he's saying is, of course, that wasn't the picture at all. What I was doing was saving someone's life. And so it seems to us that what he's really trying to say is, by analogy, folks are going to say exactly the same thing about what's going on in this canto. That is to say, it looks like I'm smashing church property, metaphorically, because what I'm doing is criticizing in the most serious possible way the abuses that are committed by churchmen of the time, starting with the top. Okay, here's what our spiritual leaders have done. Well, again, the superficial way of responding to that would be to say, blasphemy, blasphemy. Look at what Dante is doing. But he's sort of asking us to think by analogy with what he does to the baptismal font and say, what I was trying to do was bring life, and to do that, I had to smash a little property. Here, what he's trying to do in the canto as a whole, and we would even argue in the Commedia as a whole, is bring life to a moribund church, okay? A church that is more concerned with wealth and property, with material things, than it is with its spiritual mission. And indeed, the whole point of using that Simon the Magician analogy is to talk about how the relationship between the spiritual and the material has been totally turned upside down. So he's saying, here I am, to try and get things right. People aren't going to like it very much. People are going to misinterpret it. But nonetheless, here it is. Deal with it.
So here with pen rather than hammer, Dante is going to take on the same job. And as he now continues the description, what he sees is that these holes at the bottom of this ditch in hell are filled, and they're filled with legs. That is to say, people are in them upside down, and their legs are flapping, and on top of the feet that are flapping are, in fact, flames. It's a very important image, because the so-called birthday of the church is the Feast of Pentecost, the descent of the Holy Spirit, which comes as tongues of flame on the heads of the apostles. Well, of course, the Pope is the successor of the Apostle Peter in particular. And so what we have here is how upside down simony makes everything, because these guys are upside down and there's flame, and this is flame that hurts, by the way, there's flame on their feet. They really are literally upside down. They are perversions of the gift of the Holy Spirit by seeing these feet flapping and fiery.
Now, they're down in the ditch. Dante's with Virgil. Virgil says, better go down there to figure out what's going on. Dante doesn't, at this point, the pilgrim, know that it's even who that's there. He says, whatever you are, holding your upside down, oh wretched soul, stuck like a stake in the ground, make a sound or something, if you can. And so he sort of walks down there, and you can imagine the scene. He's standing, legs sticking out, flaming legs of all things. And he says, I stood there like a priest who is confessing some vile assassin who, fixed in his ditch, has called him back again to put off dying. This, too, is a kind of contemporary reference.
And it's a really neat one, because we know that the penalty in Florence for being what we would call a hired gun or a hired assassin was to be buried alive upside down. They would dig a hole, lower the body in, head first, and then before they filled in the dirt, a priest would come to hear the last confession for the good of the soul of the assassin. So Dante says, I'm there like, keep in mind, there's a pope down there, but I'm there like the priest hearing the confession of an assassin. And in fact, Dante is here playing that role of hearing the confession of the Pope. And the Pope is a kind of assassin. He really is in some way an assassin of the church by the way that this Pope and others like him, as it turns out, are involved in the buying and selling of church offices.
That vile assassin begins to speak. Remember, the date is 1300. The Pope who is alive and reigning back on earth is Boniface VIII. And it's sort of interesting then to see what this speaker, this Pope, this upside down successor of Simon Magus, rather than successor of the first Pope, Simon Peter, he says to Dante, is that you here already upright? Is that you here already upright, Boniface? In other words, what he has done is he has mistaken Dante for Boniface, because he hears that Boniface is going to come down and be his successor. Okay, are you fed up so soon with all that wealth for which you did not fear to take by guile the lovely lady, that is to say the church, of course, then tear her asunder. So here you have this wonderful you know, spectacle, kind of comedy of errors, where one pope is accusing Dante of being another who has done even worse things than he has. Okay? That he's saying, essentially, I was pretty good at this Simony stuff, but, you know, compared to you, I'm just playing, you know, minor league ball. You're in the majors. And, of course, Dante's like, what's going on here? What's going on? Well, the poet, of course, knows exactly what's going on.
But Dante the Pilgrim, just for a while, can't answer. I mean, it's such an absurd question. You know, here's this guy, and he's being asked the question, aren't you Pope Boniface VIII? It's like saying to Ron, aren't you Lawrence of Arabia?
Well, in another life.
Yeah. That is such an absurd question. You stop and say, now, there must be something beyond the obvious as to what that question means, because it's such a dumb question. So Dante sort of stammers for a little bit, and Virgil has to say, just tell him you're not Boniface VIII. And Dante's finally able to get that out and solve this little problem. I want you to notice, though, that what Dante's done here is really ingenious, because, as we've said several times, rule number one of the game for being in the Inferno is you're going to be dead by 1300. But Boniface, in fact, doesn't die till 1303. That's after Dante is writing, the date where the poem is set, but it's before Dante writes the poem. So this is a way for Dante to be able to discuss Boniface VIII directly in hell, even though he isn't there yet, as it turns out.
Yeah, so he gets Boniface in hell by anticipation. And, you know, I say, what's going on here, of course, when really it is the poet himself who makes sure that we know what Boniface's final resting place is going to be. We still don't know, however, who the person is who's talking. Okay, that identification comes just a little bit later. Okay, so the spirit then, Dante answers, no, I'm not he, I'm not he. And the spirit heard, twisting both his feet, well then, what do you want of me? If it concerns you so to learn my name, that for this reason you came down the bank, know that I was once dressed in the great mantle. Kind of fancy way of saying, I was once Pope. But actually, I was the she-bear's son, so greedy to advance my cubs, that wealth I pocketed in life, and here, myself. Well, this passage, too, deserves a little unpacking.
First of all, when he says, I was the son of the she-bear, he's identifying his family name, because he comes from a Roman family named Orsini, and from that we know who he is. Pope Nicholas III was a member of the Orsini family and was pope about 20 years before this poem is set. He died, in fact, in 1280. But keep in mind this. When someone becomes pope, let's say the current pope, John Paul II, he takes a new name. You don't become Pope Karol Wojtyła, you become Pope John Paul II. And there's a long tradition in both Old and New Testaments of a new name referring to a new identity, a new meaning, a new job to do. So Abram becomes Abraham, and Saul becomes Paul. And so what we're told is popes do the same thing. They leave aside, they put behind family as they come to be called to govern the universal church. But notice what he says, that I put on the great mantle, but I actually remained the she-bear's son. I remained an Orsini. I was operating as pope as an Orsini. I was wheeling and dealing for the Orsini family. I was taking all the cousins and giving them church offices because I was setting up the Orsini family for a long time in the future to remain powerful. And of course, in saying this, I really remained the son of the she-bear, he's also telling us exactly why he is guilty of the sin of simony.
And notice also at the last part of that tercet, that wealth I pocketed in life, okay, getting rich from the church, and here, pocketed myself. In other words, the punishment is to be in these pockets, these upside-down holes. So you have another wonderful example of the punishment reenacting the crime, the punishment being the crime, the punishment fitting the crime. So essentially, this kind of pocketing, this upside-down pocketing, is the greed that, this is the greed reenacted that he did before. Now, notice also that one of the things that's kind of nifty here about the positioning, remember, Dante is like the friar hearing the confession, and the Pope here, Nicholas, is like the assassin. Well, this is like a confession. Dante is there listening to this catalog of sins, of this sort of nepotism and greed on the part of Nicholas III. Well, the thing that's kind of nifty about it is that, once again, it's a kind of parody of confession. It's not the real thing. It's the letter without the spirit, not simply because Dante's not really a priest, but most of all because Nicholas isn't really sorry for what he's doing. Okay, this is confession without sorrow or repentance. In fact, it kind of feels like he's bragging about what he did. And he lists all of these things and then says, you know, in fact, it's a long list of people who are going to be guilty of this kind of hanky-panky.
Yeah, let me tell you how this is set up, he says. Beneath my head are pushed down all the others who came, sinning in simony before me, squeezed tightly in the fissure of the rock. And then he goes on to say, when Boniface comes, I'm going to be squeezed down. So there's a succession of folks that are in the rock, and only one is flapping his legs at any given time. The others are pushed down further and further and further in the rock. Now, go back to what we started with at the beginning of this lecture, and go back to the first line of this canto, O Simon Magus, and the story we told. You can see how these are really the guys who are the followers of Simon Magus. They're in the succession of Simon Magus. The problem is, they're supposed to be in the succession of St. Peter. They are, after all, as popes, the followers of Peter, who, by the way, name is Simon, right? Simon Barjona was Peter's name. So they have followed the wrong Simon. Instead of being those who were on the rock, because on this rock, Peter, I will found my church, they are the successors of Simon Magus, who is in the rock.
Notice that up until this point, we've actually ourselves made the point that whenever the pilgrim hears somebody's story, his general tendency is to sympathize with them, to kind of become involved, as he was with Francesca, let's say, or the pity that he feels for Pierre Della Vigne. But here, he has an altogether different response. And for the first time, we sort of see the pilgrim draw back and become extremely critical, even sarcastic and nasty to Nicholas, the very proper reaction to it, we might add, because he seems so fed up with this, this recollection, this reflection on just how corrupt the papacy has become. So I do not know, perhaps I was too bold here, but I answered him in tune with his own words. Well, tell me now, what was the sum of money that Holy Peter had to pay our Lord before he gave the keys into his keeping? Certainly he asked no more than follow me. Nor did Peter or the rest extort gold coins or silver from Matthias when he was picked to fill the place the evil one had lost.
This is one of several references in this canto to the Acts of the Apostles. We've already suggested that Simon Magus himself is a character in the Acts of the Apostles. The Feast of Pentecost is described in the Acts of the Apostles. This is a reference to the first story in the Acts of the Apostles. How do we replace Judas? Remember what Judas' sin was and the 30 pieces of silver and all that sort of stuff. How do we replace Judas? Well, as Dante's saying to those feet down there, let me say now, Peter didn't say, who's going to bid the most for this job, right? Of course not. It was done, as we learn in Acts, by lot. So there would be no hanky-panky, if you will, that God would therefore choose the successor of Judas. And so going back to that great text, the Act of the Apostles, the story of the early church, Dante is invoking a number of images here and really sort of pointing his finger and really letting Nicholas III have it.
And in fact, he keeps going as though he himself is sort of building up to this great crescendo. Were it not for the reverence I have for those highest of all keys that you once held in the happy life, if this did not restrain me, doesn't sound all that restrained to me, I would use even harsher words than these. For your avarice brings grief upon the world, crushing the good and exalting the depraved. And in fact, it might be worth saying a word or two of just what the consequences are of this sort of ecclesiastical hanky-panky and see how it's something that's not just a matter of church business and church corruption as such.
Why, after all, would you buy an office? Well, presumably because it's an investment. Presumably, you would buy an office so that you can make a profit. So that why would somebody buy an office from a pope, say a bishop? Well, because the bishop can make a profit on the wealth that the church owns, make a profit perhaps in allotting the lesser jobs in the bishop's court, or even the office of the parish priest. So it really is trickle-down corruption. But there's another problem. Who's going to become bishop if there's a price tag? And of course, one answer is nobody who should be a bishop. Because A, people who should be bishops and priests won't have lots of bucks. And B, if they did, they wouldn't buy offices because they know that's against God's teaching. So it ruins the entire structure of the church. It exalts the wrong folks. And the folks who need to hold those offices are absolutely excluded. From top to bottom, the church is ruined, beginning here in the way he tells the story with papal corruption.
And of course, notice also that what it means is that particular popes, let's take Boniface VIII, for example, Boniface VIII has access to resources, monetary and financial, that he otherwise wouldn't and couldn't have. And those resources are precisely what enables him, well, ultimately to kick Dante and the white Guelphs out of Florence. So that there's that connection also. All of this stuff is not just it's not just Cosa Nostra. It's not just the church and its own business. It's the way that the church impacts on society as a whole as well.
And Dante, notice in this speech, also says, by the way, stay stuck there, for you are rightly punished. We want to sort of throw up our hands for the first time and say, Dante, you here understand what God is doing, and you're siding with God. You are finally seeing what the gate of hell says in Inferno 3. This is a place of justice. This seems to be the first time when Dante really perceives the justice of the place. Stay right where you are. In Dante sort of saying, I accept the fact that God's got this exactly right.
It's interesting to see how the pilgrim himself builds up to a kind of rhetorical climax here. He's still going on, and he says, you have built yourself a god of gold and silver. How do you differ from the idolater, except he worships one and you worship hundreds? That is to say, the worship of the gold and the silver, which, of course, was what introduced the canto in the first place. Well, what's kind of nifty about that, in fact, there's a line from St. Paul who sort of equates avarice with idolatry. And Dante the poet is sort of picking up on that here to talk about the way in which the worst of all sins, the sort of first commandment being broken here, is really what these popes are all about. But then he hits his climax at the end. O Constantine, what evil did you sire, not by your conversion, but by the dower that the first wealthy father got from you? Again, a line that deserves some unpacking. He's talking here about Constantine, the emperor. What's he doing here? What's the point of that?
1,000 years ago, Constantine became a Christian, the first Christian emperor, from which there are enormous consequences. And a popular medieval story, which wasn't debunked until the 15th century after Dante's time, says that when Constantine moved from Rome to his new city, named for his favorite person, Constantinople, that is to say, what he did was give a lot of wealth and even political power to the Bishop of Rome, that is to say, to the Pope. And so Constantine, Dante's saying, what did you start here? You gave wealth to the church, and now look what's happened. A real condemnation that's now 1,000 years old. But what's interesting is Constantine is somebody we're going to meet up with in the afterlife. Dante has placed him in the afterlife. Constantine is in heaven. Because although Constantine did this thing with awful consequences, as it turns out, he meant well. He meant to support and sustain a new church that was just emerging from the time of persecution. And it was probably not possible for him to see the damage that would be caused a long time in the future. So he becomes one of the interesting figures we'll watch for in paradise.
Now, notice there are a couple things going on here. First, just in terms of Dante's whole system, very important to remind ourselves that people are punished or rewarded because of their motivation. So as Bill pointed out, Constantine meant well and is rewarded for that. So it's important to keep in mind. It's also important to see that in sort of giving us this final ringing peroration here, O Constantine, what evil did you sire? The pilgrim sounds suspiciously like the poet did in the opening, O Simon Magus. All right? that was the poet speaking, sort of warning his audience, hey, we're going to get to something really good now. At the end, the pilgrim's knowledge has reached that of the poet, and we see in that what Dante has learned in this canto.
And from here, we're going to continue to look at the eighth circle by meeting two very interesting sinners a little bit further down in the next lecture.
Lecture 10, The False Counselors.
Remember that we left off in the eighth circle. Ron pointed out in the last lecture that, in fact, there are two circles of fraud, circles 8 and 9. We're in what's called the area of simple fraud, as opposed to compound fraud. Compound fraud, the ninth circle, we'll be dealing with that in the next lecture, is fraud perpetrated against those for whom there's a special bond of trust. And so we're going to remain now in the eighth circle where we have this simple fraud. And we've already seen that wonderful event where Dante sort of gets God's justice in his conversation with Nicholas III. We got to tell you, it's a rocky road. Even when Dante makes progress, it's not automatically all downhill, literally or any other way, from here on. For example, in the very next canto, where Dante encounters the fortune tellers, their punishment involves such twisted bodies, or shades, technically, that Dante starts weeping. And Virgil really lets him have it and says, you know, stop that. This is not a place for that. Dante has been a backslider in a certain way. It reminds us that although Dante in some ways is sort of over a particular intellectual hump when he has this encounter with Nicholas III, it's by no means automatic. It's not a habit yet. And we're going to see a lot of backsliding on Dante's part. He's still got a lot to learn. We still have 4/5 of the poem to go. We're going to focus now, for the rest of this lecture, in a particular ditch of this eighth circle where, unusually for the Divine Comedy, Dante and Virgil have two totally different conversations in the same place with different people. And so it's going to be a way where we're going to have two very different looks at the same sin, which will allow us to stop at the end and say, what exactly is the nature of this sin? It doesn't have as obvious a label, as obvious a name as simony or pandering or seducing or flattering or fortune-telling or whatever. So we're going to be looking at cantos 26 and 27, Virgil primarily chatting with Ulysses, and then Dante chatting with a more or less contemporary Italian named Guido da Montefeltro.
Whatever the sin is called, it's sin of misdirected intellect, and the two figures represent that, as Bill says, with an ancient model, Ulysses, and the more modern model. Let's talk a little bit about Ulysses first. Dante certainly knew about Ulysses, but he only knew about Ulysses from the Latin sources, not originally from the Greek. So that, for example, the heroic Odysseus, the hero of Homer's great epic, Dante doesn't know about him firsthand, only in summaries that had been handed down to him in Latin translation. But he knew the role that Odysseus, now become Ulysses, had in Virgil's Aeneid. And basically, his role there was to be resident slimeball among the Greeks. And in fact, one of the things that's very interesting about Dante's portrayal of Ulysses here is that he starts out taking the Ulysses that is present in the Aeneid, giving us a picture of that guy, but then extending the story, that is to say, Dante's own creation becomes part of this canto, where he takes what's known and adds to it his own version of the story. And he starts, turns out that they have a really interesting punishment, these sinners. They are encased in tongues of flame, all right? That they're sort of inside flames. And when Virgil and Dante encounter this sort of split flame, we find out that it has inside it Ulysses and his buddy Diomede, that is to say, the guy who was his buddy in perpetrating all kinds of fraudulent things in Virgil's Aeneid. So essentially what you get is that Ulysses, all right, he said, within, Ulysses and Diomede are suffering in anger with each other. Just vengeance makes them march together now. Another one of those pairs that Dante the poet seems to be so interested in. We had Francesca and Paolo. We had Farinata and Cavalcanti. Now we have Ulysses and Diomede. And he says, all right, there they lament inside one flame, the ambush of the horse become the gateway that allowed the Romans' noble seed to issue forth. In other words, that's a reference to Aeneid Book 2, which we spoke of earlier, the fall of Troy. Ulysses was the great engineer of the Trojan horse. He was the one who's responsible for that stratagem, and for that, he's being punished now. And also being punished for the theft of the Palladium. Again, Book 2 of the Aeneid steals a statue of Minerva. Again, it's a kind of sacrilege in Virgil's poem. That's what he's here for. But it turns out that what he did in the past becomes somewhat less significant to Dante than what happened after that in a story that he tells to Virgil about what happens after he gets back from the Trojan War.
Remember how the story basically goes. 10 years in the Trojan War, 10 years getting back to Ithaca, where he's from, where he's left dad, his wife, and a son. And so you may recall, if you've done the Homeric version, this great homecoming scene. Well, this is very much redone here. Again, as Ron pointed out, Dante had not read Homer. What we're told is, gets home, not sweetness of a son, nor reverence for an aging father, nor the debt of love I owed Penelope to make her happy, could quench deep in myself the burning wish to know the world and have experience of all man's vices, of all human worth. Gets home, hangs his hat up and says, gosh, haven't done everything, haven't been everywhere, bye, and takes a journey. Now, you might ask, what's Dante's source for this? I don't recall this either in the Aeneid or in the Odyssey. Where does Dante get this? And as far as scholars know, and God knows they've searched a lot, Dante makes it up. That is to say, this is one of the great creative moments where Dante takes this age-old story and he adds to it and carries it out to, in fact, the death of Odysseus.
Might add that Dante's willingness to do this is one sign among many that Dante gives to his readers that I want to play with the really big boys, okay, that the unsurpassed reputation of Homer and the reality as well as the reputation of Virgil, Dante saying, okay, I'm going to add something to it myself from that story, that Trojan story that's new and that's original and that takes things in a rather different way. Notice also, by the way, that coming home to wife and to father and to son is a very good thing to do, but even more, the virtues of loyalty to family, as represented in wife and son and father, would have been pretty much what defined another hero that Dante is constantly bringing up, Aeneas himself. In other words, what we're seeing here is that the way to take a look at Ulysses, as Dante describes him, is as kind of an anti-Aeneas. Here are the qualities that he had as a hero. Ulysses is the guy who negates all of those qualities by saying that kind of loyalty, that kind of pull, that kind of tie, that doesn't count anymore. What I want to do is go out there and have experience, and experience, as he puts it, all of men's vices, all human worth. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not, in fact, experiencing human vices is a good thing to do. It seems to me that you could argue, you know, that if it's, let's say your thing is you're very interested in a drug problem and you want to deal with rehabilitation, that it makes a lot of sense to visit a lot of rehab clinics and do all that kind of stuff. It doesn't make sense to say, well, in order to understand this from the inside, I think what I will do is shoot a lot of cocaine and a lot of heroin because that way I'll be able to understand what goes on much better. That there's a kind of knowledge that it's better off for us not to have. And the most important thing, I think, that's coming out of this canto is that we have to learn how it is that we're able to make distinctions between knowledge that's worth having and worth going after and knowledge that is forbidden. Essentially, Ulysses's t-shirt reads, "No knowledge is forbidden." Okay, no such thing as forbidden knowledge. And it seems to me that that's the portrait that Dante is having Ulysses paint for himself.
It's also, ultimately, as we all know, just not in the cards to be able to experience everything. For example, this is something Augustine had to learn. I can't experience everything. Sooner or later, I have to decide what I trust and whom I trust. And of course, Ulysses trusts only his own experience. In particular, he trusts only his own sense perception. And he talks about the fact that if I can't perceive it with the senses, then I have no access to it. And I want to know everything, and so I've got to experience with my senses everything. It's another important facet as he takes off on this journey. He doesn't do it alone. It isn't that, you know, I'm going to put on my backpack and go out and learn everything. It's he fires up the old boat and the sailors who came back with him, and they all take off together. Dante says these are tired men. These are men like Ulysses who've been away for many, many years. But he's the king, after all, of Ithaca. And so there is an enormous social consequence to this, what sounds like a kind of solitary quest for experience. And we never want to lose track of the fact that whatever happens to Ulysses happens to a lot of other folks in this journey as well.
Well, and in fact, one of the things that Ulysses is good at in Homer's version, in Virgil's version, and here in Dante's version, is giving a good speech. He's doing that to Virgil, of course, down in hell. But what he does is sort of recreate the speech that he gives to these tired old men to get them to go on the journey with him. "Brothers," he said, "through 100,000 perils have made your way to reach the West during this so brief vigil of our senses. Do not deny yourself experience of what is there beyond, behind the sun, in the world they call unpeopled." Well, by the time he finishes the speech, they're, as they say in the coaching biz, they're ready to run through a wall for him. And they do. And essentially, the pitch that he's giving to them is, hey, trust me. Well, in fact, that trust leads nowhere except to their death. And it's also interesting to see, he has this wonderful image talking about what they're doing. Okay, "We made our oars, our wings for that mad flight." Well, of course, the people who are manning the oars are these old guys that he has gotten to go along with him. So there's this sense in which the fraud that we're dealing with is the ability of somebody to persuade others to do things for you. That seems to be a large part of what Ulysses here is all about.
And notice, as Ron so well put it, he's saying to these guys, trust me. This is the guy who doesn't trust anybody. This is the guy who says, I've got to do it all, see it all, touch it all, smell it all myself. This is the guy who won't buy anybody else's version, but he's saying to them, trust me. Again, what a wonderful way of thinking about what fraud is. Here's a guy that says, trust me, I don't trust anything.
And what's sort of interesting is that the symbol for going beyond the limits of already understood knowledge was to go outside of the Straits of Gibraltar, and they sail out there. Now, we mentioned in an earlier lecture that nobody in Dante's time thought the earth was flat. Only people who really thought the earth was flat were the people who made up the history books in the 1950s. Okay? They knew the earth was round. But what they weren't quite sure of was the exact size, and they tended to get it a little bit smaller. And because of that, and of course this relates to Columbus a little bit later on, they didn't believe that there was a large landmass between what they knew where they were and the east. So, you know, Columbus, he tried to make the voyage to the east, ran into the Americas instead. Ulysses, he gets out there, and what he runs into is the most wonderful, one of the most wonderful of Dante's own creations, Mount Purgatory, which is, in fact, what we're going to be talking about when we deal with purgatory in subsequent lectures. He gets there. From a distance, he sees it. And all of a sudden, the ship sinks. What's important, of course, is that he leads himself and his men to death. But also, it turns out that this is a kind of nifty image for the fact that Ulysses is a kind of model for Dante's pilgrimage. And it tells us that what Dante is doing the right way, with Virgil as his guide, remember what Bill said about Ulysses' sort of do-it-myself attitude, what Dante gets to with the guidance of Virgil and the help that comes to him ultimately from above, Ulysses trying to do on his own doesn't get to. Sees the mountain, falls, dies, but of course in the process leads a lot of other people to death with him. Three times in a churning waters, the fourth blast raised the stern up high and sent the bow down deep as pleased in others' will, and then the sea was closed again upon us. And we see the ending of Ulysses and his men.
In the next canto, again, Dante and Virgil stay in the same place, in the same Bolgia, and therefore they meet up another sinner punished the same way, that is to say, encased in a flame. But it's a very different conversation. Virgil really does the talking with Ulysses. Now, Dante will do the talking with, again, roughly an older contemporary, Guido da Montefeltro, who's been dead a very short time in 1300. And therefore, if we don't have a label right away for what exactly the specific sin of Ulysses is within that category of fraud, perhaps we'll be able to figure out what the nature of this is by looking at another example of it and sort of playing the oldest game in the world. Take two different stories and see what they have in common. What is it that's going to link these two very different stories in terms of the essence of what these sinners tell us about themselves? Guido da Montefeltro was a nobleman from the northern part of Italy. He was a political partisan. He was a Ghibelline leader for many years. And right at the end of his life, he decided that he would become something else. He became a member of the Franciscan order. And in fact, he gets involved in some of the political shenanigans of Pope Boniface VIII. So his story is going to relate to some of the other stories we've heard, especially, for example, the story of Boniface VIII by anticipation in Inferno 19. And I think we'll find this is one of the most interesting and very deep parts of the entire Inferno.
Notice also in terms of what Bill said before about what connects the two, one thing that strikes me now, just as Bill says this, is clearly Guido's story is implicated in all of the events of Dante's own life, since it deals with Boniface VIII and all the political stuff that clearly results in Dante's own exile. So what you have is a story that is obviously related to Dante and therefore has a kind of direct relevance and a direct message for him. But it's important to point out that exactly the same thing is true with the Ulysses story earlier, which is to say, right, what Ulysses's tendency to do is to say, look, I have the kind of talent and ability that allows me to manipulate, that allows me to get what I want, and that creates a huge temptation which Ulysses obviously gives into quite readily. For Dante, he has to see that there's a kind of similar temptation in his journey, if you will, because, of course, for Dante, he's got to recognize that he has himself a kind of talent and ability, and the question is how to put that to use. So the story of Ulysses' journey really becomes a lightning rod for all of the concerns of Dante the Pilgrim in this broad metaphorical way, as Guido da Montefeltro's story becomes a lightning rod for Dante in this very precise and clearly specific way.
Let's take a look at how Guido introduces himself by telling a little bit of his own story. He says, I was a man of arms, and then a friar, believing with the cord to make amends, and surely my belief would have come true were it not for that high priest, read Boniface, his soul be damned, who put me back among my early sins. I want to tell you why and how it happened. While I still had the form of bones and flesh my mother gave me, all my actions were not those of a lion, but of a fox. The wiles and covert paths, I knew them all, and so employed my art that rumor of me spread to the farthest limits of the earth. First of all, that's probably not true, by the way. He's a fairly important regional figure, hardly a worldwide figure. But notice he uses this image of the lion and the fox. I was tricky. I didn't win battles by, you know, being the strongest guy in the battlefield. I knew how to do all the diplomatic parts. I knew how to outfox, we would say today, my opponents. I could beat guys stronger than me because I was really, really clever. And so this is the kind of military career that Guido had. Well, then, why abandon it and become a Franciscan?
First thing I want to say is that description that Bill just gave sounds an awful lot like Ulysses. Okay. Second thing is that he abandoned it because he says, well, I saw that the time of life had come for me as it must come for every man to lower the sails and gather in the lines. Notice, by the way, that what he's doing there is saying, here we are getting close to the end. Got to sort of, you know, think about my soul now. But he uses the metaphor of life as a sea voyage, which, of course, is another neat linkage to Ulysses. But then he says, all right, things I once found pleasure in then grieved me. Repentant and confessed, I took the vows a monk takes. And then in one of the great lines that anybody speaks, I think, to Dante, and oh, to think it could have worked. Now, there are a couple of ways to take a look at that. One of them is to assume, yes, he really was repentant and that would have worked and he would have been saved, except that he went back to his old ways. You know, the story that he's telling is in parts here. But it seems to us, at any rate, that it makes a whole lot more sense to read this as, oh, to think it would have worked means what I was trying to do, having scammed all of these other people in my life. Toward the end of my life, I was sort of trying for the ultimate biggie. I was trying to see whether or not I could scam God. Okay, and doing it by putting on the robe and the cord of a friar. Okay, so that if I wore friar's clothes, then people would think I was a holy man. But more important, I could fake out God.
Okay, I'm going to put on my Franciscan suit, and I think I'm going to have it made. But then, as it turns out, Boniface VIII was involved in a very serious military activity in the Papal States against another one of these Roman families, an enemy family of his family, the Colonna family. Remember, again, talking about all this family politics with regard to the papacy, think back to the family politics in the papacy in Inferno 19, Nicholas III and Boniface by anticipation. So he's involved in this war, and the Colonna are holed up in the city of Palestrina. If you've ever been there, it's way up on top of a mountain. It'd be a very hard place to take. And so Boniface wants to capture this city. And just having enough weapons and soldiers won't do it, largely because of where it's located. He needs a sly old fox to tell him how to take Palestrina. And so he calls on Guido de Montefeltro. That's brother Guido de Montefeltro.
Yeah. Well, brother Guido, he says, that is telling us in this narrative that the problem was that I was not in the business of doing that kind of stuff anymore. Okay? He has a kind of elaborate way of saying it, but he says as follows. As Constantine, another character who recurs a lot throughout the Commedia, once had Silvestro brought from Mount Soracte to cure his leprosy, so this one sought me out as his physician to cure his burning fever caused by pride. He asked me to advise him. I was silent, for his words were drunken. All right? What Boniface wants is advice on how you zap your enemies. And Guido is saying, well, I can't give that kind of advice now. I'm not in the advice business. I'm in the friar business.
However, Boniface is not going to give up. Fear not. I tell you the sin you will commit, it is forgiven. Now you will teach me how I can level Palestrina to the ground. Mine is the power, as you cannot deny, to lock and unlock heaven. Two keys I have, those keys my predecessor, who resigned as Pope, did not cherish. Okay, Boniface says then, you give me the info as to how to take this, keep in mind, city full of Christians. Palestrina is in Italy. The Colonna and all the residents are Christians. You tell me how to take that city, and you are already forgiven of the sin of telling me how to blow away fellow Christians.
Well, that's kind of a neat trick. Problem with it, of course, is that it's something that's not in Boniface's power to do. It's not in God's power to do as far as that goes, because it's a contradiction in terms. It's nonsense. It's meaningless. If you are to be forgiven, it is because you are repentant. And if you are repentant, it can't include the knowledge that I'm going to do this thing. Okay? So essentially what happens is that the way Guido tells the story, Boniface makes him an offer that he can't refuse, all right, both in terms of the terms of the offer and in terms of the office of the person who's making it. Hey, I'm Pope. I tell you what to do. And he says, I bought it. Okay? Now, he says his weighty arguments had forced me to the point that silence seemed the poorer choice. I said, Father, since you grant me absolution for the sin that I